The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Peter Schulman, Chief Executive Officer of Urban Teachers, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
One of the biggest challenges in the field of education is to find talented and committed individuals to teach in poor and underserved school districts, most of them located in the urban centers of America. An even bigger challenge is to keep them, to not have them burn out and leave the teaching profession altogether after just a couple of years. One organization that believes that it has found an approach to better train teachers, prepare them for the classroom, and lead them to become lifelong educators is Urban Teachers. And it's a pleasure to have with us now their Chief Executive Officer, Peter Schulman. Good evening, Peter, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver. Real pleasure to be here. I appreciate you having me.
So, Peter, what is the mission of Urban Teachers?
So our mission is to combat racial and socioeconomic inequality by preparing culturally competent career teachers who improve the educational and life outcomes of underserved public school students.
Mm-hmm. And you only became the CEO of Urban Teachers earlier this year, having most recently served as the Deputy Commissioner for the New Jersey Department of Education. What sold you, Peter, on taking this job?
So I think, you know, as someone who got into education first at the district level and went to the state level, all of my training, all of my research, all of my experience has sort of proven out or borne out that, you know, the most important factor in any student's education and in-school factor, that is the quality of the teacher in mm-hmm. front of them. It's, to me, something that we're never going to teacher-proof the work that we do, nor should we. We're going to disintermediate the need for great teachers. And as we see the inequities play out in the way that access to money, resources, great teachers, namely in this country, urban and rural students get the short end of the stick.
Yep.
So Urban Teachers was an organization that I had met my predecessor, the CEO, probably 7, 8, 9 years ago when she was getting this off the ground,
mm-hmm.
and really believed in the model and really believed in the idea that this was something that takes hard work. There's no silver bullet. There's no quick fix. And by actually raising the bar around preparation with deeper and more clinically based preparation to prepare novice teachers was something that was essential for the schools in America.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing similar work at the policy level, so it was great to see an organization like Urban Teachers doing this in practice. And it was sort of a sliding doors moment that as Jennifer Green, the founder and initial CEO, was leaving and I was transitioning out of my government role, there was an opportunity for me to sort of apply for her job.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the profession of teaching in the United States today? How it's perceived by the public? How attractive a career it is for young people, and how even do current teachers themselves view their profession?
So I'll make two overarching statements. One is I believe teaching is the most important profession we have in this country. Two is I'm not going to paint the perception with one brush. I think the world we live in likes to create a narrative which is sort of generalizing from the particular. Having spent time with hundreds, if not thousands, of teachers over the past 13 years, they're vastly different, as any skilled worker in any vocation would be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that as a country, I don't think we value teaching in the way that we should. I don't think we necessarily compensate teaching in the way that we should. At the same time, I'm not sure we understand the world of a teacher, and I'm not sure the world of K-12 understands necessarily what's going on in other sectors. At times, it's a bubble unto itself. So as we think about this, that I think in terms of that level of valuing teachers, part of it becomes giving them the right level of preparation, coaching, training, support.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I think that's essential. And I think it's that not only do our teachers deserve it, but our kids deserve
mm-hmm.
it.
Let me generalize, if I may, here and give you a narrative that I think are in a lot of people's minds, and it has to do with teaching in urban schools. What happens is you get a young, idealistic teacher arriving, really wanting to make a difference, but before very long, She burns out. She leaves teaching. And this happens over and over again. And as a result, the schools face instability, and they're the schools that can least afford it. Why does this happen so often?
So, you know, I'm not going to give you the scientific reason, because I think there's a variety of answers. I'd say let me give a couple hypotheses, and certainly it's a nice lead into urban teachers.
Mm-hmm.
First is the job is really, really hard. Okay? The work is really hard. So I think that before we get into thinking about what the ideas around preparation or compensation or support or mentorship, this is really hard. The way that we've structured urban education or education in this country, it's segregated. It's fragmented, right? We have residential housing segmentation. We have structural racism. We have gerrymandering districts. And more often than not, as we think about the divide within our classes of economic and races across the country, it manifests itself in K-12 education. So it's really hard work. Two is that I don't believe the folks are prepared. So part of the reason that we hear that individuals are leaving, and I did work as the director of recruitment in Miami-Dade County Public Schools, and I've worked in places like Wilmington and Camden and Trenton and Newark, is they're not prepared. And oftentimes the training that they've had in their preparation program, whether it be traditional or alternative route, is divorced from the reality of how hard the work is. And when they're put into this typical school district or school or classroom, if you will, it can be an isolating profession. And if they're not supported and they don't have had the training and they don't have the leadership in the building, or maybe not, there's not a system of supports that are set up, a lattice of supports, if you will, to ensure that they're going to be successful, it's, you know, I think it's a real concern. And then the other side of it is, should a first-year teacher be given a full slate, given 5-6 classes with multiple preps? More often than not, because of sometimes seniority rules and sometimes just the culture of the building, novice teachers are put in the most difficult situations. I don't think that's right.
Right. Sometimes it's like starting a rookie quarterback in the NFL in the first game, and he doesn't know nothing. And
I think that's a fair analogy. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, Urban Teachers offers the most comprehensive coursework and personalized support of any other teacher training program, at least that I've ever come across. Walk us through it.
Yeah, so I would say that I would say that I've come across as well. So I can't make that assertion because I don't know every training program in this country. So our model, which is a joint venture with Johns Hopkins, we're a nonprofit organization. We have a 4-year program. So we have an upfront, very, very rigorous interview selection period where we're trying to identify candidates that not only have the skill set but also have the will set to actually do this work. They bring the growth mindset. They really have an understanding of and passion for making change in urban environments. And our program begins with a full year of clinical residency.
Mm-hmm.
So the first of the 4 years of the program, you are not a full-time teacher of record. You're in a school building with a host teacher, getting observed, getting coaching, doing coursework at night, which you're then able to apply in a clinical setting the next day, and that coursework is working towards your master's degree.
Mm-hmm. A little bit like a medical residency, isn't it?
Very much so, yeah. Very much so. And I think that, you know, for us, certainly as you think about what it takes to be, whether it be a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant,
mm-hmm.
over time these professions have raised the bar and they feel like more preparation is needed, and we really want to be selected because the jobs are so difficult, right? But what it's done is actually it's made those professions more attractive as
yeah.
we see the numbers of folks that are wanting to go into those mm-hmm. You know, levels of both higher ed schooling and then, of course, into the vocation. Years 2 through 4 of our program, that individual becomes the teacher of record in the classroom. They continue to complete their coursework and get their master's degree. They continue to work towards their professional certification in the state that they serve or the city in the state where they work and get support by us. And the idea is that that certification and degree orientation is only going to be granted if they show that they're effective. So they have to keep their grades up. We use some level of quantitative data. We use observation data to actually ensure that that novice teacher is not only prepared in terms of what we would think about from sort of an academic viewpoint, but actually in practice can be a great teacher that can be in front of children.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, children deserve it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about this residency program. So I am a teacher in training, so to speak,
yes.
that first year. I am being mentored, would that be fair to say, by the existing teacher in the classroom?
So you have mentorship with the existing teacher in the classroom, but we also have clinical faculty that works directly with you that we have folks coming in to observe and coach you in real time.
Mm-hmm.
You're then also doing coursework at night with other residents going through the program, and you're working on sort of pedagogical content knowledge. You're giving mock lessons. You're learning some of the methods classes. content knowledge to the certification area that you're pursuing.
This sounds reasonably rigorous.
Oh, goodness, it is. And I have to say that, you know, many of our folks are in their, you know, mid-20s, early to mid-20s. And looking back, I'm not sure I could have done this program. It is extremely rigorous. And I think that as our individuals go through it, some call it a rite of passage, if you will. Mm. Some during the residency are very critical of it, how hard it is. But when they reflect on it, and I've talked to folks that have been 2, 3, 4 years out of the program, they understand why it was needed.
Sure.
Right? They understand why it was needed, and that level of preparation has put them on a path for success.
Well, our memories are funny that way, too. We always have a fondness around
them,
but
certainly not while
we're in the middle of it.
Sure, sure.
But
no.
It sounds a little bit like working for one of these big consulting firms, where you start out, you're just doing those 70, 80-hour weeks.
It is absolutely hard. I mean, in my first week on the job, I spent some time with what was called our resident advisory group. So these are residents, and it was probably in May. I was about 2 weeks into the job. So May is they're sort of in the seventh or eighth inning of their residency year. And I spent time, I went down to Washington, D.C., and I met with a small group of 7 or 8 of them, and they were just spent. I could tell that they were mentally and physically exhausted. And I said, one funny piece of this is that I said, you know, I'd love to buy you lunch. It was as if they'd never seen food before.
Uh-huh.
They're ordering extra food to go. They're ordering double. I have at it. But I said, are we treating our residents well enough? But
they sound like people in the media when it comes to food.
Yeah, no. But I'll say this. I don't want to lose that it is so inspiring to speak with them. And the passion they have for this work and the commitment and the time and the energy that they have devoted to honing their craft and to really focus their moral compass on a subset of our population that is often not in folks, you know, front view.
Right.
It is really unbelievable.
Yeah, it also seems very reciprocal because you invest in them a lot. And one of the ways in which you do that is you provide coaching for all 4 years. Tell us about that.
So, you know, this work, again, can be extremely isolating. And I think that, you know, as you think about urban teachers, it's not the idea of urban teachers that can make us successful. It's about how we execute.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, we invest a lot of money in identifying faculty and coaches that are highly skilled educators in concert with Johns Hopkins. They spend a tremendous amount of time observing our folks directly, coaching them and saying, I just sat through and watched you teach. I watched your lesson plan on algebraic reasoning. I watched you deliver that lesson. I watched how you differentiate instruction. And we have our own teacher practice rubric across 20 power standards are our main core of it that we look for certain context clues. We look to see what's being done in practice. And we're able to actually record this information to meet with someone to debrief, to call it a post-observation conference, and see how they're improving over time. And as they're getting coursework, as they're working with their peer residents, and as they're working with their coaches, as well as their host teacher, as well as maybe the principal in the building, they're starting to get a confluence of feedback. And in some ways, I always believe more is more, especially at that sort of nascent stages of becoming a teacher. And we believe, again, we have high-quality folks that are doing the observation and that are giving feedback. It's rigorous. It's consistent. It's actionable. And again, there's no shortcuts. There's no cheap way to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the reason, again, our program is sometimes we call it a Cadillac model. It's an expensive, rigorous, you know, high-touch program. It's what we believe in.
Mm-hmm. How many of your first-year teachers complete all 4 years of the program?
So as we think about our work, we look at the first year of the residency. We have an attrition 15 to 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Much of that is folks that we either believe were not ready for the classroom or they themselves have said, this is not for us.
Yeah.
And let me put that in a positive light. From the view of the 9-year-old, the 12-year-old, we want to make sure that when that individual is the teacher of record, they're ready for that teacher. They're learner ready day one. So in some ways, as we think about, you know, our attrition metrics, our retention metrics, the idea of the residency year for us is getting folks prepared. Then when we think about how many folks from year one to year four, their first 3 years of teacher training, we're close to 80%, 78% of our folks, which when we look across our urban districts, we're talking that's 15 to 20% percentage points higher than what we see in most areas.
Mm-hmm. And there's a good deal of research that indicates that retention rate does affect learning, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as we think about, from Malcolm Gladwell on downward, teachers improve, especially in the first 5 to 7 years of their teaching career. This is where they actually continue to really accelerate the learning curve. So as we think about, really getting folks past that inflection point within the first 3 years and pushing them towards being career educators, they're honing their craft. They're improving their skill. And again, as I said, it's not divorced from what we see in other professions, mm-hmm. right? Anyone who's novice in a certain vocation is going to take some time to become a highly skilled professional. And that's what we believe the same should be true of teachers.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the start of the process. And that is, how do you recruit and who applies?
So great question. So we are continuing actually to better understand our data and our metrics. So we cast a very wide net.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look at this, typically we have a lot of folks that have a little bit of that ideological mentality. These are folks that are coming from, bachelor's degree programs all over the country. We also have some career changers. We have some mid-career professionals. But in general, we're trying to get individuals that reflect the children we want to serve. So this talks about, in terms of their own diversity, over 50% of our cohort are people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them, I think over 30%, are first-generation college students. 40% of them had received Pell Grants themselves. And for us, it's not only an ideological element. The research proves this. There's a lot of research from Constance Lindsay and other folks that's saying that as students, especially African-American boys, have teachers that reflect them, it actually translates
right.
to dropout rates, mm-hmm. fewer suspensions. I mean, this is real stuff, real data proving this. So for us, it certainly aligns, again, with sort of our moral compass, but it also translates to higher degrees of instructional acumen.
Men don't generally gravitate to the teaching profession. So how have you been doing with men of color?
So I think the number that I read most recently is 2% of our teaching population is African American men,
mm-hmm.
right? 2%, which is certainly not indicative when you're working in a Baltimore, a Dallas, a mm-hmm. DC, where you can have classrooms that are 70% or 80% African American children. So first and foremost is the road is steep. Certainly where I came from most recently in New Jersey, 77% of our teachers were Caucasian women.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where, we spend a lot of time recruiting. And this is everything from going to recruitment fairs on campuses, doing search engine optimization, if you will, and Google AdWords and all that fun stuff. We do work with folks like Teach for America and City Year, folks that are similarly, looking at these type of candidates because we think there's synergies and folks that may not be ideal for their program but might want to be interested in our program. We think there's some, again, economies of scale there, scope rather. And it's really, for us, continuing to really cast a wide net to get people who are interested. And then the next phase of it is really having a tight funnel mm-hmm. to actually figure out sort of who the sort of contenders from the pretenders are.
Gotcha.
And I think in this day and age, a lot of individuals will say, that sounds interesting. They'll float a resume in. They'll start an application. But as they understand, do you really want to be a teacher? Do you really care mm-hmm. about urban children? Are you devoted to this? Do you want to be a lifetime educator, right? What is your growth mindset? Because if you don't have a degree of resiliency yourself, where we were going before is we're going to see a lot of attrition.
Sure.
So we got to make sure we find the right people. And I'll say that we haven't cracked this nut.
Mm.
Trying to better understand this and trying to understand what the right elements or attributes are of that perfect candidate, it's going to be accretive over time as we continue to learn.
It's always going to be a work in progress.
Yes.
You'll never get there. You'll always be making it better and better and better.
Well, I'm hoping yes. That's right. That's right.
Those cities you just mentioned a moment ago, are those the ones you operate in?
Yeah. So right now we're in 3 cities. Again, we're in Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and Dallas. 9 years ago, we started in Washington, D.C. and Baltimore, mm-hmm. probably being our flagship with our partnership with Hopkins. And then about 3 years ago, we added the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Peter, how do you view or measure the impact that you're having?
So it's a great question, one that's also that we're evolving. So I think that I look at this is that, the reason that I'm personally in this work, and I think that all of my colleagues and most all of the teachers, is that we want to impact the lives of children. Right? Children are the unit of measurement.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look at them, we want to be able to track them longitudinally. And the idea is for them to have, productive lives, right? And sort of what are the metrics that are the sort of leading and lagging indicators within that? So first is that for us is there's growing relational databases and state longitudinal data systems that are starting to allow us to track this. Certainly test scores and graduation rates and starting to understand, you know, are folks going through to and through college and eventually getting to gainful employment. I think probably 10, 15 years ago when I started in education, this data was not within reach. I think it is now.
Yeah.
I think it's for us. It's certainly an opportunity to actually better understand, you know, where our folks are going, but also trying to figure out what is the causal, not just correlation, but what is the causal relationship between our teachers and these results? And for us, what are the set of conditions for success? Is it clustering a number of urban teachers?
Mm-hmm.
Is it finding the right principal? Is it finding the right school? Is it finding the right district that
what
has
the
right curriculum? What are these levers? Because I don't believe our program unto itself can be a single lever. We got to be part of a cohesive solution. And on the teacher side, there's a number of indicators. We talked about retention,
mm-hmm.
right? We talked about observation scores. We are going to see folks' GPA. There's a number of metrics that we're using. These, we believe, are proxies for quality. Again, I don't think anyone individually is a perfect proxy, but the compound or the confluence of these elements together give us a hypothesis that we can test against to say, are these teachers effective? And then what are the conditions that we're going to do to support them to actually sort of elevate, you know, their effectiveness,
yep.
and then track it over time.
What's your business model? How much of it's earned income? How much philanthropic dollars? And who have been some of your key supporters and partners?
Great question. So we have a budget of close to $24 million. We are about 60% earned revenue and about 40%, $9 million or so in philanthropy. This number, just to be clear, is something that we continue to reduce over time as a percentage of our overall budget.
Right.
It's important for us as we think about being a fiscally healthy organization, as we think about sustainability, and the practical nature of wanting to actually do something that can actually sort of over time impact the K-12 ecosystem. In terms of our funders, we're really fortunate, and again, I can't take any credit for this. We have a combination of national funders like the Schusterman Foundation and the Overdeck Foundation, the Walton Foundation,
mm-hmm.
folks that have really been invested in K-12. And for many of them, the sort of what they call it, the human capital element is one element within their portfolio as they think about other change agents within schools. And then at the local level, and I think this is equally, if not more important, we have local foundations and these, you know, in Baltimore, when you think about the Abel Foundation or the Blaustein Foundation, these are folks that are very invested in the city. And they've put millions of dollars to try and improve the quality of outcomes in that city. So we're a part of that portfolio. And what's really exciting to me about that is, as I think about the work and what I talk to our team about, we want to go deep, not wide. The goal is not for us to be in 75 cities
mm-hmm.
across the country. The goal is for us to really go deep in Baltimore, to really think about this as a part of a generational solution to what are generational problems. And to us being, again, part of a broader emphasis to say, is there a community movement? Is there a broader K-12 push to say, how are we going to work on this together? And for us, that's where we want to plug in. That's where we want to do work. And it's probably not as sexy or appealing to say. It's like, this work takes time. It's going to be hard. We want to be there for the long run.
Yeah.
We don't think there's any quick fix solution to this.
Yeah, well, I admire your discipline because there is such a temptation on the part of boards of organizations in particular to be in more cities all the time. And you have a model here that you're still proving out. So before you take it over the country,
yes.
let's get it really, really right. And that does take time. Tell us about your corporate culture at Urban Teachers and maybe give me a thing that you and your team do that in the workplace that you think is particularly cool.
So it's interesting. As the so I'm still a newish CEO.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, what's unique for me in this role is that I'm entering an organization where there's some level of it being incumbent for me to fit into the culture. I need to mesh. There had been a culture there. So I'd say what's both interesting and challenging. So we're an organization, as you know, clearly mission driven, that talks about diversity, equity, inclusion. So we've talked a little bit about that today in terms of what our recruitment
mm-hmm.
process looked like, what the composition of our cohort. But these are values that we want to live both personally and professionally. And we wrestle with this. And certainly as a white CEO, I wrestle with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think what is unique about, you know, where the organization has been, I think something that we're continuing to evolve in is that we're going to put the tough conversations on the table. I come, you know, from, I would say, for the last 13 years I've been at district and state government, where it probably would be breaking some regulation for us to have some of these conversations because they're hard to have.
Yeah.
And for us, these manifest themselves in not only the spirit by which we do the work, but actually operational decisions. And I can sort of talk about it, you know, as we think about our admittance processes and we see that in our desire to recruit and bring African-American male candidates into our cohort, we see we had some barriers.
Mm.
We had put up some gates. And as we think about that, how do we remove those barriers? How do we provide additional supports? How do we think about equity, right? Not just equality, but equity, meeting folks where they are and supporting them to actually get over those hurdles to make sure that they are ready to be in our cohort. So I think, you know, what's really impressive about Urban Teachers is not that we have a perfect inclusive culture, but we have the will to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we have an outspoken nature where anyone in the organization, and they've done this, and say, Pete, you're the CEO, you're wrong in this case, or you need to think about this, or there's a teachable moment for you, and making sure there's not just a hierarchy of, I can't say this to that person because, you know, it's on the step scale of the ladder,
sure.
I can't do that.
Feedback can go from any person to any other person in the organization.
Yeah. And we've been, you know, there's a lot of folks that have been reading the book Radical Candor and being saying that you got to be able to say that. And even if someone is a colleague, a friend, you have to be able to let someone know that, you know, what you said or did or how you acted or how you're thinking about this, you know, needs to be, you know, rethought. Or maybe you didn't consider X. And I'm someone who believes, especially, again, I'll reiterate this, as, you know, as a white male, I have blind spots,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's not just, you know, me having the best of intent. That's not good enough, right? It actually has to play out not just in my thinking but my actions.
Sure, sure. Sometimes if you haven't lived the problem, it's harder to address the problem.
Absolutely.
And knowing that is one of the best things you can possibly do.
Right.
Because it keeps you learning and it keeps you open.
That's exactly where I was going to go. I think that one of the things that we push our children, we want to talk about this term lifelong learners. Well, we as adults should be the same.
Yeah.
And I think that's, for me, that's got to be part of our culture in Urban Teachers. And I think, again, I'm fortunate to be stepping into an organization that has sort of laid the blueprint for this over the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me close with this, Peter. You're the new CEO, so I would imagine your vision is still being formulated. But where do you see the organization being 5 years from now? Where would you like it to be?
So I would like us to probably close to – so I think we're bringing about 300 residents a year now.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly want to move us to a conversation more about impact than simply resident quantity numbers. But I do see us potentially adding maybe one more city, moving the number from 300 to 500 or so residents,
mm-hmm.
Reducing our reliance on philanthropy from probably 40% to 20%. And really make a concerted effort to study our impact, really invest in R&D, really invest in data, and really invest in sort of what I would consider is real continuous improvement. I would also say the lofty or the aspirational vision here is to really accelerate the dialogue in this country around teacher preparation. From a magnitude standpoint, we're a drop in the bucket. We think about the, you know, hundreds of thousands of teachers who entered the profession. So how can we be a proof of concept? How can we start to change the narrative? How can we actually show that more deeper, rigorous clinical preparation is essential for the profession and start to change policies, start to change regulations, start to work with, you know, higher ed in this country and through a different lens? Because I think this is something that's genuinely possible, and that excites me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Peter Schulman, the Chief Executive Officer of Urban Teachers, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us what's on your website and how people can apply for the program if they might be interested.
Oh, fabulous. I get to do a plug. It's urbanteachers.org. You can go there. You can apply directly on the website. Our application is open. You can learn about our program. You can see anecdotes from our residents. You can learn about the cities we serve. And you can have access to, you know, to all of our staff and alumni to really understand what we're about.
Thanks, Peter. It was a pleasure to have you here.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks so much, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.